once again showing his versatility.
I think we have five number ones.
Everything's coming up Milhouse.
But $22 million for Brian Daubeck, give me a break.
And Redmond has been thrown out of the ballgame.
NFL tight end, you know, those playing years are dog years.
Maybe it's adamantium. Maybe it's vibranium. Maybe it's something really cool I don't even know about yet.
Welcome back to another episode of the 300s Podcast. My name is Red, and as usual, I will be your host. Today we have the chief of the Midwest Bureau, Big Z, joining us from parts unknown. How goes it out there?
Goes pretty well. It is a feels-like temperature of about 100 degrees outside, but in this podcast basement, it's about 70, so it's feeling pretty good down here.
Well, that actually sounds pretty pleasant. My podcast studio is, I'm staring at a couch right now. I have some denim to my left. I have a few dresses to my right. And it's about 150 degrees in here with all the equipment. So
I don't want to show off. I don't want to make people jealous. But I am in my podcast studio right now in sweatpants. That's how cold it is in my basement. I'm sorry. It's a humble brag.
In your own house. Come on. Don't want to sell it short.
Well, the podcast game is big these days.
you're gonna bankroll the 300s ventures when we launch our own VC program.
Whatever it takes.
All right, so seeing it as the dog days of summer, and there really are no other Boston teams playing right now, unless you count the Rebs and the Cannons, pretty much everyone's attention has been shifted towards the Red Sox finally. This team is on a roll, and really the only show in town right now, especially with NBA free agency over, NBA draft is over. There's really nothing to look forward to until Hard Knocks and NFL training camp. So with that being said, that's going to be our focus today.
Well, Mr. Burns had done it. The power plant had won it, with Roger Clemens clucking all the while. Mike Socia's tragic illness made us smile, while Wade Boggs lay unconscious on the barroom tile. We're talking softball from Maine to San Diego, talking softball.
Now, I want to start with a blog post you wrote today, Rick. It was titled, "The Death of Baseball Has Been Greatly Exaggerated." So I know there's been a lot of talk, especially around Boston, about how baseball is dead, it's dying, it's too slow, no one's watching. But you dispute that.
I do dispute that, and it was one of those things I really couldn't put my finger on it. But Nick Cafardo had a great tweet, I think it was Tuesday night. Nick Cafardo's tweet said, "Nesson has done a 6.16 household rating over the first 85 games of the Red Sox season, a rise from 5.15 at the same juncture in 2017. There's also a rise of 13% in adults 18 to 34 and a 36% rise in adults 25 to 54. Comparison, the Celtics finished at 3.2 and the Bruins at 2.9. So that kind of confirmed two things that I'd always felt, I'd kind of always assumed, but I could never really put my finger on it. Just because the interest in the Red Sox seems to be down, that doesn't mean they're still not one of the biggest stories in town. As I wrote in my blog post, yes, the Patriots are the number one team in town. They probably have been for about 5 years. I would say maybe 2012. I think I put Bobby Valentine's season as kind of the line in the sand where the Patriots took over the town. Patriots have the best quarterback and the best coach in the history of the league going right now. If the Patriots didn't own the region, there would need to be another federal investigation into that team. I understand why the Patriots are the number one team in Boston and New England. But all this stuff where the sky is falling on baseball, yeah, the game needs some fixes. But just because it's not the A number one topic on the Sports Hub or WEI anymore doesn't mean the game is dying or that interest is dying in Boston. And Nick Cafardo's tweet was really just a punch in the face to that narrative.
Yeah, and it's definitely not fair to compare it to the Patriots. This is one of the most popular, obviously it's the most successful, one of the most popular teams in one of the most fanatical sports markets in the country. So to say the Red Sox aren't interesting and they're not something fans care about just because they're not beating the Patriots, well, that's just a stupid comparison. No one's going to be beating the Patriots, not until they go back to, you know, Pete Carroll days where they're winning 8 games a year. And even with the Patriots, with as bad as it is for business, all the drama that's been going on with that team in this offseason, that only adds fuel to the fire, because a lot of these times where they're kind of measuring what's interesting, you're kind of going off of, you're not really looking at ratings. You're listening to sports talk radio and what they're talking about, what fans are calling in about, and what drives calls more than drama. You've had Patriots drama with Belichick and Brady, and obviously the Super Bowl with Malcolm Butler, and then Gronk's contract situation. Then the only thing with the Red Sox is, yeah, they're crushing it, but people are just calling in to rip on David Price for being a bitch.
Yeah, and I mentioned the Red Sox are really victims of their own success. They broke the curse in 2004. They went wire to wire in 2007. They won a championship in 2013 after a city tragedy. On the negative, on another negative side, 2011, that epic collapse, that Bobby Valentine disastrous season in 2012. They've had a lot of highs, a lot of lows. They've had a lot of drama. I mentioned the Nomar trade. What the hell could they possibly do to top that from 15 years ago? There's nothing they could do at the trade deadline that would be nearly as dramatic as trading the face of the franchise in the middle of the season. So the fact that there's not as much buzz about this team on sports talk radio in the middle of July shouldn't be what we're looking at to determine the interest in this team. We should look at the ratings, and the ratings are pretty damn good.
Yeah, that's something where I feel like for a couple of years it was down because they didn't have the stars. They didn't have David Ortiz retired, obviously, and the team sucked. I mean, last year they weren't going anywhere. They had one of the worst offenses in the league, and then it showed in the playoffs. Now, my only concern is this is going back to the old, you remember the book Feeding the Monster. Now, there was the arguments between the baseball side of things, the op side of things, and Theo Epstein, and the TV side of things, and Tom Werner, where they basically were, Theo was saying, I want to build a team, I want to draft prospects, I want to be boring, I want to, you know, just build from within. And you had Tom Werner coming in saying, well, no, we need sexy stars. Johnny Damon's sexy. We need to get names and that, you know, pink hats can like. And
John kind Goodman, of bred it. Roseanne.
Yeah, John
sexy
Goodman.
Or else Bill Cosby, sexy Tom Werner stars.
American sex symbols. But and that obviously over time just devolved into just chasing expensive over-the-hill free agents. You know, John Lackey was one of them, but he actually turned things around. But more so, like Carl Crawford, and then the worst fucking ones in Pablo Sandoval. So I worry about them kind of seeing the ratings being up and saying, "Oh, we right set the ship. We fixed everything by signing JD Martinez for $100 million."
Well,
like, yeah. Well, that's because it worked out very well. He's playing very well. The team's better. It's not because you got a free agent I'm watching.
What has changed since that last pair of bad signings? Handler Ramirez and Pablo Sandoval. Charrington's gone. Dave Dombrowski is running the ship right now. So you mentioned feeding the monster, and one side wants to be entertaining, and the other side's more interested in winning baseball games. I think that conversation is over, and I think the baseball side has won. Otherwise, I don't think Dave Dombrowski would be here. Maybe Theo Epstein, at the age of 34, could look across the table at Tom Werner and say, "You got to get the hell out of here. We're winning baseball games. We're not producing a TV show." Maybe he didn't have the stones to do that at 34. Dave Dombrowski wouldn't be in the building if he had to put up with that nonsense, in my opinion. Dombrowski is many things, but I think he is the big swinging dick at the Cracker Factory. I think he's running the show. I think this team has learned from that, and I think they know you got to win to be interesting, first and foremost.
Yeah, and in response to that, I have two things. One about Ben Charrington, I think you're right. I think Charrington he's a smart baseball guy. He drafted a lot of good prospects, but he also was Theo's guy. And when he got thrust into the role of being the GM, being the face of baseball operations, he probably wasn't ready to kind of make those hard decisions and tell ownership, no, this is not what we need to do right now. So agreed. He probably was getting cucked by the TV side of things. But on the other side of that, for better or for worse, you got Dave Dombrowski coming in saying, listen, this is what we're fucking doing. This is why you brought me in. These are the deals we're making. And the Red Sox are saying, yeah, we need to win. You're right. We'll do whatever we have to do. But then you go and you look at teams like Detroit that he's left, and they're just fucking god-awful in large part because of him just sapping the entire system of any type of prospects and saddling them with gigantic contracts.
He does raid the farm system, but let's remember where the Detroit Tigers were when he got to town. That team was losing 100 games a year. He never was able to figure out a bullpen. He was never able to get them over the hump, but he took them to a couple of World Series. I don't want to say he saved baseball in Detroit. That franchise had been there for 100 years before he got there. But he brought the Detroit Tigers back to respectability a lot quicker than the Kansas City Royals got back there.
And the Kansas City Royals are an interesting situation because they were awful pretty much
30 years.
Our entire childhood growing up. They started drafting, and this is also where I get off the train of like teams like the Rays. Oh, they're so well run when they get a good run every once in a while. It's like, no, you had a top five pick for 10 years in a row. You fucking better figure it out sooner or later. But the Tigers the Royals are a team that worries me just because that was a team that they were terrible for so long. They finally got good. They got on a good run, and they made the World Series. They were great. They won the World Series 1 year. But now they fall off almost immediately, and that just seems like, is that a team that went too all in? But that's probably not a great comparison for Boston. Boston obviously has much deeper resources than them, but cautionary tale. And I'm trying to pull up Detroit's records right now. I mean, right now, let's see, last year they won 64 games. Before that, going backwards, it was 86, 74, 90, 93, 88, 95, 81, 86. So those are probably the Dombrowski years. And yeah, I mean they haven't lost 100 games yet, but they're well on their way this year. Last year, 98 games they lost.
It all runs in cycles with the Royals, though. You're right; they won the World Series, I believe, in 1985. Didn't make the playoffs again until 2014. They weren't even good in 2014 until the second half of the season when they started to catch lightning in a bottle. It just goes to show, though, if you're going to play that game where you're going to tank and you're just going to try to stock up five number one picks in five straight years and roll the dice and see what happens, that window is going to be very, very small. We've seen that with the Pirates. We've seen it with the Royals. The Rays kind of did a better job because they were a pretty decent team from 2008 to a little bit more recently. So they've had a better window than a lot of those other teams. But you play that game, the wheel goes around and you get one bite at the wheel every 30 years.
Yeah, not exactly a good team to be a fan of, nor is that a great team for Manfred's dream of parity.
Yeah, and we'll get into this later when we talk about some of the changes I have proposed, and it's not just me, it's been proposed all over, but I feel like a salary floor would really disincentivize teams from just trying to play the draft for a dozen years and trying to catch lightning in a bottle. Spend some money, because that's what Dombrowski did in Detroit. And you could say that he plundered that team's farm system and now they're paying the price. They were in the mix for the better part of a decade. I would rather that than Kansas City's 30 years of not mattering.
Yeah, and I don't know. It's hard to make the comparison directly because obviously I don't want to be Kansas City where you suck for 30 years. And that's never going to happen with Boston. It's just you have too much money. It's you're too big of a market. It's never going to happen. But I do worry where if you just trade away all the prospects and you start sat on the team with $200 million contracts of fucking bums like Price, who, you know, we like to rip every week. But if you do both of those things, where you have no prospects and you have big contracts and then guys like Craig Kimbrell probably going to leave at the end of this year, I feel like that's going to put you in a bad position. And it's not going to be a 30-year cycle, but it might be a 3 to 5 year down cycle. And I know Theo's thing was always trying to keep the team going with prospects while also bringing in some veterans without totally blowing things out of proportion. And that's where you got the team was pretty successful consistently with a bridge year here and there in like 06, but there was never a 3, 4, 5 year drought because they always had that funnel always filled in one side or the other.
The only thing I'll say about that David Price signing, he has not been great in Boston, but this year he has been 9-6, and it's helpful that he is on a good team where he gets some run support. Because that ERA is 4.5. But in 3 years in Boston, he's 32-18. ERA 3.99. Certainly not worth the money, but that is not a guy that is going to sink your team the way a Hanley Ramirez could or a Pablo Sandoval could.
Yeah, and he's also not selling drugs, so we can give him that.
That's a check mark in his column. That's a pro.
Allegedly. Now, this is something that you had just touched on a minute ago, so let's just get into that right now. In that blog post you put up today, you had said some blasphemous things. You had some rule changes that you wanted to talk about, some things you think would improve the game. Now, I know baseball's been working on some of them. They've been instituting them mainly in the minor leagues. One, you know, banning dip. Two, the pitch clock. So there's a few things that they're trying out to try and improve the game, speed it up. What are the changes you think are going to make the game better? I know there's one that I completely disagree, but what do you think?
So we'll just get right into it. I think they need to institute some sort of ban on shifts. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but you don't need the numbers to know that shifts have gone up astronomically over the last 15 years. I remember as a kid watching that Red Sox Home Run Heroes video, and they would show teams that would shift against Ted Williams. You know, the greatest fucking hitter of all time. Now they are doing shifts against the likes of Jackie Bradley. They are doing shifts that are turning Bryce Harper, a generational talent, into a 216 hitter. He went from being baseball's first $400 million man to, we'll see where he ends up. We'll see where he ends up after this season. But this is not baseball putting four guys at second base. And I don't think it would be hard, and I don't think it would be outrageous at the major league level to task the home plate umpire with saying, look, there's an invisible line from home plate into center field. There are going to be two guys to the left of second base, two guys to the right of second base. After the ball is hit into play, do whatever you want. If you want to bring in a fifth infielder when it's bases loaded, nobody out, bottom of the ninth, tie game, fine. We're not going to bust balls on that. But this shit, we are putting four guys at second base, no. That's not baseball.
I got to say, I think that is blasphemous. I am of the mindset, and I used to say this every time Ortiz would bitch and moan, there'd be fucking six guys on the right side of the infield and no one on the left side besides the left fielder. Like, dude, just slap down a fucking bunt. I don't care if you want to try and hit 80 home runs. Like, you're batting 220 in the shift. Just try and slap it down the other side if it's that big of a shift. And you will bat 500 in the shift. Now, obviously not every player can do that, but I think outright banning it, I think that takes away a lot of the strategy. It's not like it's I know one of the things you're probably going to talk about is just lowering the mound years ago. That was more so of just a dominance. That was a physical, statistical thing as far as I'm higher up, I'm a gigantic guy, I'm throwing downhill, it's harder to hit the ball. But moving guys around, I feel like getting rid of that, that's strategy. If you can't hit the ball the other way, that's too fucking bad. I was playing softball last night, and I readily admit, I know the guys play me to left field because I haven't hit a ball to right field since I was in about eighth grade. I don't even try anymore because I know I can't. But that's why I play beer league softball in Brighton.
So you say it's strategy. I say it's a spreadsheet. With all the computerization and all the statistical information right now that they have, they can look at spray charts and say, look, this guy hits it on the ground, it's going to the right. I just say, if you ban the shifts or you put some rules in there preventing them from stacking five guys at second base, you will increase offense that are not home runs. And I like the sound of that because I am not terribly pleased with how the game is becoming the three true outcomes. Walk, home run, strikeout. Add a little bit more variety in there. Put the ball in play. Again, I don't think baseball is perfect, but Shaughnessy put in a good note in his column. Verducci said the time in between balls in play is about 3.5 or 4 minutes. If you eliminate the shift, I don't think it's going to increase runs per game by 10 or anything drastically, but put the ball in play, have some action. You know, it's going to be hard. I don't think you could legislate guys always taking the first three pitches of an at-bat, never swinging at the first pitch anymore. Never thought we'd miss Nomar for that. But we can at least say if the balls are going in play, you know, move it around, see what happens. And getting back to lowering the mound, you know, probably in 1969, they said, guys are a lot taller than they were in 1869. Maybe it makes sense to lower that mound for that physical advantage that they had, being 5 inches higher. Baseball has been around for a long time. It's okay to tweak the rules right here. We're not saying put a fourth outfielder out there. We're not saying run the bases the opposite way. We're not saying anything crazy. We're just making tweaks, something the NFL can do every year, and I think they're roundly applauded, rightfully so, as being the best league for tweaking the rules every year to keep things interesting and entertaining.
Yeah, and I'm all for testing and tweaking. I don't necessarily agree with banning the shift, but I am totally for changing the rules, testing things out. I think pitching clock's a great idea. Oh, you need 60 seconds to get ready for the next pitch? Well, go do it in fucking Pawtucket.
I'm not opposed to the pitch clock, but I don't know if that's the solution. Another thing I've heard out there, baseball takes too long. Let's just make it 7 innings. If you make a game 7 innings, you're going to have 5 pitchers a night. I don't think that's the answer either. I think just more balls in play, because again, if they're not shifting against Bryce Harper, he's not going to be trying to hit home runs every time. He might be trying to slap down some base hits. Maybe he's more likely to swing at the third pitch instead of the seventh pitch. But yeah, you have a generational talent who's going to be a $400 million man. Spreadsheets are taking that away. I don't think that's good for the game.
So something I'm surprised with, you bring up spreadsheets and analytics, something we saw in the last 15 years was the rise of Moneyball and really the fall of Moneyball. And not that Moneyball doesn't work anymore, but where people get it confused is Moneyball was all about OBP and all that. It wasn't about that. It was about taking advantage of an underutilized metric, and OBP was one of them, which is why guys like Kevin Youkilis were undervalued and Billy Beane plucked him out of, you know, a diamond in the rough, basically. What I'm surprised about is people adjusted to Moneyball, so it's not really the same advantage it used to be 10 years ago. I'm surprised with all these spreadsheets and all these metrics with all these shifts of here's how this player goes. I'm surprised there hasn't been kind of the revolution the other way, saying here's how we can beat the shift. And maybe the players just haven't caught up yet, or maybe they're too stubborn, you know, as baseball players are known to be. But I'm surprised there hasn't been some kind of counter-revolution.
Yeah, they definitely can be stubborn, but I think there's limitations to physical ability. It is harder to push the ball, especially on the ground.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we're talking about rule changes here. Just Google Baseball Almanac rule change. You can look at the timeline of rule changes over the last 150 years. This is nothing crazy. The NFL does it every year. They move back the goalposts in the 60s. They change the kickoff rule now. You can't drill the center on a special teams play anymore. I don't think what I'm proposing is anything crazy. Another thing I'd mentioned is just a salary floor. One of the complaints I hear about the Red Sox are, they're playing bad teams for 3 weeks. Why am I going to watch them beat up on all these last place teams? To which I say, I like it when the team scores a dozen runs. Call me crazy. And this team is making a serious run for 100 wins, and I find that very interesting. I hope they're not talking about it in the clubhouse. We saw how that turned out in 2011. But us as fans, I think we should be, and I am excited about the potential to run down 100 wins.
Yeah, and this is something where I feel like this happens a lot in Boston, usually during like the slower parts of the sports calendar. But I feel like the entire Boston sports media, they have a secret meeting. They go to the Boston media, what do they call it, the lounge?
The lodge.
Yeah, the lodge. The lodge. I feel like they get together at the lodge, and they decide to all harp on one topic or two topics, and they all talk about it, whether you're reading the Globe or the Herald or your 985 or EEI. They all do the same fucking thing, and it's usually in those down periods. And the most recent hot take du jour is that no one cares about the Red Sox, and they're not that good. And I'm so sick of the media ripping the Sox for beating up on bad teams. Like, Jesus Christ, you play the same teams as every other team in your, you know, one in your division, but similar teams. Like, the Yankees are playing the same exact fucking schedule as you. You're playing the teams that are on your schedule. If you have the Royals back-to-back with the Rangers they're playing this week, what are you supposed to do? You know, defer to them and not beat them? Like, I know Lou Maloney's been on a crusade tweeting out, he's probably had a few cocktails, but he's tweeting out last night, JBJ had a double last night. We got to take that off the board because it was against the Rangers.
Well, and the other thing is, if they beat up on bad teams, they're just beating bad teams. But if they lose to bad teams, oh my God, the season is over. This is what this team is. Didn't we tell you? They're in a no-win situation. So I mention a salary floor because I look at teams like the Minnesota Twins spending about $130 million this year. If they're going to win 70 games or they're going to win 80 games and they're still going to miss the playoffs, why should they go and invest with a guy like J.D. Martinez for all that money when they get Logan Morrison to fill the same role for $1 million. So there's no incentive to spend a little bit more money to win a few more games. So another thing I said was cut a few games off the season. I know the season used to be 154 games. I think some people have hinted at 156. Even if it's 158, we saw how bad the weather was in April. Take just a handful of games off the schedule. Hell, make it 160. I know the NHL went from 84 to 82 at one point. And then turn the division series into 7 games. That way you kind of make up the TV money on the back end. And it would make the regular season more important ever so slightly. And also, if you make the playoffs, you're guaranteed an extra home game.
So speaking of rule changes and kind of moving things around in terms of number of games and maybe even in the playoffs, what is your take on the wild card play-in game? I personally, when it first started, I was like, I don't like this because you could play 162 games and then have it all come down to one game. But in the years since, just kind of watching how exciting it is, obviously, the Red Sox are in it, I don't want to be in it. But I think it, one, adds a huge incentive to winning the division, which was never there. Growing up, it was like, oh, the Red Sox got the wild card. Cool, we'll just play whoever else. Whereas now, if it's the last week of the season and we're playing the Yankees and, you know, it's a one-game difference, are you going to go balls out to win the division and then risk having just a shithead like Price starting the wild card game? I personally love it. I think it makes it that much more exciting and puts that much more emphasis on winning the division.
Yeah, I've got no problem with it. I won't go out there and say I love it, but I was in favor of it when they put it in because that game 162, game 163 was always exciting. So it's a little bit of manufactured excitement, but it's tough to beat a winner go home game. So again, I won't go out there and say I love it, but I like it. It's a way of increasing postseason participants without turning the postseason into a 2-month trudge like the NBA and the NHL. And
yeah, and you
speaking of those leagues, no. One thought that just came in my mind too. We talk about the Red Sox beating up on bad teams. Do we see who the hell the Golden State Warriors are playing every year? How many NBA teams have a chance at winning a championship next year? I would put it at 3, maybe 4. So if the disparity in teams isn't a problem, if tanking isn't a problem in the NBA, it's not a problem in Major League Baseball. You can't have it both ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think that harping on beating on bad teams is such a bullshit excuse because everyone's playing the same group of teams. And if you're one of the teams beating up on the bad teams, then you're clearly one of the good teams. And there may be a bigger discrepancy from a good team to a title contending team, like there is in the NBA, whereas, you know, you get a team like the Toronto Raptors could get the 1 or 2 seed, but they would get their doors blown off by Cleveland or Golden State. But that's just the way it is.
But I like that one game wild card playoff. And like you said, it really incentivizes winning the division. Of course, it would suck if the Red Sox were in that game. It would suck if the Red Sox and the Yankees have the 2 best records in the league and they have to face off in the division series because the Yankees are a wild card team. But hey, those are the rules. 40 years ago, they were the 2 best teams in the league and they only got that 1 game playoff. So for lack of a better expression, shit could be worse.
Yeah, and that would be a gigantic kick in the dick if they both win 100 games and they have to play a 1 game playoff. But guess what? As you said, that's the manufactured excitement that baseball needs. If they had the Red Sox, if they had Red Sox with 105 wins playing the Yankees with 106 wins or whatever the schedules end up being, I guess they have both the same number of wins, but they're playing each other with 100-plus wins each in the one-game playoff, it'd be the highest-rated baseball game in a fucking decade.
And you talk about pitching changes. There would be about a dozen pitchers on each team in that game. You might have guys come in to throw one pitch.
Yeah, and that's one of those things where when they do it in July, you roll your eyes. But when they do it in September and October, and you can see the guy's breath, and there's, you know, that much riding on every single pitch, it's fucking awesome.
David Price starts the game, allows a hit to left, and there's action in the Red Sox bullpen already. I mean, it would be David, nuts.
If David Price gets a start in the postseason, which he will, they shouldn't call it a start. They should call it what the Rays call it. What is it, an opener?
Yes.
Any future David Price start in the postseason moving forward from this point on will be called an opener. I promise you that.
It's like when Terry Francona moved Wakefield to the bullpen but didn't call him a reliever. He's a starter. He's just going to go to the bullpen for a little bit.
Yeah, he's just pitching later on in the
game. It's not you. It's me.
Now, the Sox, so they're pretty much, they're on pace to win, what did you say, 100 and 11 games or so?
At the start of business on Wednesday, they're at about 111.5. We're taping this Wednesday night. If they win Wednesday night, they're on pace for $112.
So the Red Sox may not be your typical cruise to the World Series that you'll see with a team that wins 100-plus games. You usually see the teams that win 100-plus games just rock through the playoffs and they get to the World Series. They probably aren't going to be that team, especially with a team like Houston standing in their way. But with that being said, it's pretty fucking hard to knock out 100 wins.
Yet,
does this mean I
you got to show up every
does this
day.
Mean I've, yeah, does this mean I have full confidence in them going into the playoffs? No, but that's more of a knock on the Sox teams of the past 2 years taking a dump in the playoffs than it really is a reflection on the current squad who might win 110 games.
Yeah, and that's the one thing that is not out of the Red Sox control, why interest is down. Because I think fans are saying, we've seen this movie before, we'll catch you in October. But then again, like I said, just because they're talking about it less on the Sports Hub doesn't mean that people aren't watching. But yeah, I think people will tune in, come to the playoffs, and talking about possibly the Red Sox and Yankees meeting up 100-plus wins in the first round. That's part of the reason why I would say let's extend the division series to 7 games. At least 7 games is a little bit less of a crapshoot.
Yeah, and they're on this historic pace, and it's really incredible to watch. I feel like people have really started to take notice the last couple of weeks. It's the the dog days of summer. It's when really it's the only game on. But really just kind of looking at the team itself, I feel like I probably still won't really officially buy in until they win a game or two in October. But your record is your record, and they're one of the best teams in baseball, and they have one of the best offenses in baseball. This year, they are, at the end of as of yesterday, they were first in runs scored in all of baseball, and they were second in home runs. And this is just a year removed from last year when they were 10th in baseball in runs scored and 27th in homers. That is a fucking massive improvement.
Yeah, and J.D. Martinez really does look like the straw that stirs the drink.
Holy shit, talk about a good free agent signing. Like, I wasn't of the there was a bunch of people around town saying, I remember Tony Mazz was breaking out his spray chart on Felger and Mazz saying, oh, this one's going to fall in right field. This one's going to fall. It's going to hit the monster. It's going to take away a home run. He's not going to do that well. I didn't think he was going to hit 60 home runs, but I was like, all right, if he hits 30, great. He's almost at 30 at the half.
He's putting up comparable numbers to Manny Ramirez's first season at half the total contract, 100 and change, as opposed to about 200.
Yeah, 18 years later, too.
Yeah, it was a good signing. And it just looks better and better every day. You just hope that this guy can keep it up in future years. But to hell with that, he's making his money now.
Yeah, and he might opt out and try and go get that money and submarine it somewhere else. So he might be an Adrian Beltre situation for all we know.
I'm the type of guy, but if you want to opt out, that's great. If it works out, you'll be back here. If not, love you, mean it, best of luck. That's how I felt about Adrian Beltre all those years ago. Hey, best of luck, pal. I didn't think we'd be talking about his Cooperstown plaque.
I did not think we'd be talking this many years later saying, fuck, I wish we really did sign him that year. But going back to J.D. Martinez, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I saw on EEI they had an article comparing and saying that J.D. Martinez and Mookie Betts are approaching, if not exceeding, the totals of a 3-4 hitters in the lineup of the old days of Manny and Ortiz, which is insane because back then it was 40 and 140 every year for those two. And it was insane. It was automatic. And it seemed like, oh, this is going to go on forever. And then Manny left and then Ortiz still continued to do great for a while. But those days seem to be gone. But these two, they might replicate. They might exceed it.
Yeah, it really is incredible. And everyone talks about Mike Trout having one of the best statistical seasons in the history of the game. Mookie Betts is right there with him.
Yeah, Mookie Betts. I mean, one, fuck Mike Trout. I mean, do you know anything about Mike Trout besides the fact that he was in a Subway commercial like 4 years ago?
He's from Jersey, and I think I know he's from Jersey because I find it ironic that he plays in front of a Subway, or he's a Subway spokesperson, even though he's from Jersey. He should be a Jersey Mike guy, right?
Oh, my God. The guy is drier than fucking paint.
But saying that about Trout, Bryce Harper, I've never seen the guy smile. So when you talk about baseball stars being lifeless, I get it.
I will say Harper is kind of like the yin to J.D. Drew's yang, where J.D. Drew was boring, he didn't say anything, he was emotionless. Bryce Harper is slamming his helmet. He's got long, glorious hair. He's always just kind of been a yappy dickhead. You might not know much about him either, but he's at least interesting to watch, love him or hate him. If you ask 10 people about Bryce Harper, you'll get 5 love him, 5 hate him. If you ask people about Mike Trout, everyone's going to go,
I don't know. Bryce Harper perpetually looks like a guy who's been cut off in traffic.
I like it. I want a guy that looks like he's about to fucking snap. That's why I used to love Alfredo Aceves on the Red Sox.
We'll have to go back and look at the tape of that Papelbon Harper fight.
Oh, yeah. Papelbon's a psycho. Papelbon got him in a death grip, kung fu grip on his neck. So, you know, not... This is usually the case. Everyone that acts like a tough guy is never usually as tough as they think they are. And Papelbon made that clear very quickly.
He's always accountable for his actions.
But just to go back to JD Martinez for a second, just to really kind of expand on how well he's playing this year. So he's arguably the best hitter of baseball, and he legitimately made challenge for the Triple Crown. Before Wednesday night's games, JD Martinez was first in home runs in the league, first in RBIs, and he's third in batting average. Mookie Betts is first, by the way. Not to mention he's second in slugging and third in OPS. So batting average is probably the toughest to make up ground, but he's only about 15 points behind Mookie before Wednesday's games. So this is definitely a race to watch.
Yeah, he's about 15 points behind Mookie, which is a lot. But the second place guy, Altuve, is only a few points ahead of him. So it's possible if Betts goes into a slump and Martinez doesn't. I mean, would it shock you that if Betts finished the season hitting 337 and Martinez squeaked up to 339? No, it's not like Betts is hitting 365.
Now, are we going to see the opposite of when Ted Williams was batting 400, whatever year that was, when he hit 406, and it was the last game of the year, and they told him he could sit the game out if he wanted to keep his 406, and he said, no, I want to play, and he risked losing it just so he could go hit, and he still obviously got it. I think he raised his batting average that day.
I think he started the day at 3995, which would have rounded up to 400, but you're correct. He said, to hell with that, and he raised it to 406.
So if we get to the last weekend of the season and Mookie's got a point or whatever over JD, do they finagle that? Do they do an anti Ted Williams?
If there's not a contract bonus in it for one of them.
Yeah, Mookie's still getting paid bowling money. Mookie's going to say, fuck your Triple Crown, I need to get paid.
Yeah, you make a good point. Mookie still has money on the table.
All right, so I know we've been kicking around some ideas for new content that we can build upon, and we really want to have some weekly things. Obviously, we kind of shoot the shit every week, but we want to have a couple of things that you guys can kind of look forward to. And one of the things that we wanted to introduce was the 300's top three.
Three, oh, it's the magic number. Yeah, it is. It's the magic number. Somewhere in that ancient mystic trinity.
Now, this week's top three is all yours, Rick. I think we're going to go in a baseball direction.
It's the middle of July. It's hot as balls. I want to watch some baseball movies. And there's a lot of good movies. A couple of weeks ago, I posted Angels in the Outfield right on the 300s. I shared it from YouTube and some guy who presumably stole it from a movie studio, but it was a good flick, but not in my top three. We're going to kick it off with Field of Dreams. The ultimate sports fantasy movie shows how sports and baseball in particular can move people, bring people closer together. You know, we're high on nostalgia right now. That movie is a heavy dose of nostalgia. Probably more nostalgia for guys my dad's age, but if you're a baseball fan, it's always in the top three, whoever you are. Number two, I'm going to go with Bull Durham. Pulled no punches. Really shows how much of a trudge life in the minor leagues can be. Another Kevin Costner flick. There's some great stars in that movie, too. And that one, it's better than your traditional lousy baseball movie. But for my top baseball movie, I'm going with Major League. If for no other reason, Bob Uecker steals the show as Harry Doyle.
I just want to say, your top three baseball movies, how did Summer Catch not make that list?
Because I know enough about the Cape League to know that that movie's complete horseshit.
not a great experience working down the Cape.
I like Diet Coke and hot dogs. I just prefer not to be paid in them for working in the heat.
Well, it's a long summer. There's a lot of baseball. I'm actually going to a Portland Sea Dogs game this weekend, and lucky me, Tebow's not in town, but luckily the New Hampshire Fisher Cats are in town, and I get to see if the guy fucking doesn't sit. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and his .407 batting average.
Back from injury?
I'm not. Actually, I don't know. I got to look that up. He might not be.
It was a blow to the minor leagues. They have their biggest star in years, and he gets hurt.
I'm going to have to go down to Hartford Yard Goats, try and catch the Rumble Ponies in town so I can see Tebow, the only minor leaguer I still give a shit about since half the Red Sox farm system. Yard Goats hats are fire. I mean, it's kind of hard to top my Osos de Pilares hat. That's actually a pretty top hat. I'll have to post that. I'll tweet that out there. That's hard to beat.
I just want to say one thing about that Paw Sox nickname. I love it because so many other teams are just so goddamn lazy. You can't put Los in front of your team and make it a Spanish team name. Los Marlins, that's not the Spanish word for Marlins. Los Lakers, that's a made-up word.
Los Heat.
Thankfully, the Red Sox have never done it, but it would be tough for the Red Sox to do something like that because it's not six letters. The Spanish term for Red Sox, of course, is Medias Rojas.
I gotta say, they actually did trick me because I'm a dumb person, but I saw that. I was like, Osos de Pilares. I'm like, what the fuck does a polar bear have to do with the Pawtucket? Oh, that's their mascot.
I believe the Spanish word for marlin is aguaja.
Doesn't really roll off the tongue so well.
6 years of Spanish. I hope I got that right. But you get what I'm saying. And I saw the Brewers do it. The Brewers have heritage nights every once in a while. And what I really like about the Brewers, they will write brewer or beer maker in Spanish or German or Polish across it. Just because you put the definite article the in a different language in front of your team name doesn't mean that's your team name in that language.
Yeah, give us a little bit of credit. I mean, I might not speak Spanish or understand a whole lot of it, but I am much more likely to buy a Fire Flames Osos de Pilares hat than I am to buy, like, a Los Heat jersey, you morons.
Just lazy.
All right. Now, is there anything else that we want to touch on? I feel like there's a lot of baseball we tackled, a lot of rule changes. We talked about the Red Sox, their historic win pace. We talked about the lodge that is the Boston sports media trying to just drum up shit in July. As I get it. There's not a whole lot going on. They got to fill hours, but I'm calling bullshit. Is there anything else that you think we need to tackle?
Jerry Thornton would say, you're right what you're told. And that's what it kind of seems like is going on in the lodge right now. With their wood panel walls and the smoke billowing through the atmosphere.
They gotta fill space like the rest of us, just trying to punch that clock and get that 40 hours.
Jerry Seinfeld used to say the biggest thing with the newspaper is, all right, we just finished. We have to do this again tomorrow?
All right. That's going to do it for us here on the 300s podcast. Thanks again for joining us once again, Rick, from the Midwest Bureau. Appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
Now, if you've been moderately enjoyed what you heard here today, please subscribe to the 300s podcast on iTunes, Google Play, and we are now available on Spotify. So wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. All right, thanks, guys. We'll see you next time.